Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail! Where I talk like that for some reason.
Yes is the answer to your question.
Look, you introduce a podcast like 94 times. You start trying to mix it up. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Anyway, this is the show where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. For the purposes of this podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
Yeah. And here's how this podcast works. You write to us. You can send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a snail mail address. It's a P.O. box. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
You can write us in a letter at Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and you send us emails. You can ask us questions. You can ask for us recommendations. You can take us to task for things we've said on other podcasts. You want to start a debate, you want to know what candy bars we like, I don't know, whatever you want, really. This is your show, and we get to as many as we can every single week, and that's it. We don't like to dilly-dally at the front if we can avoid it. We just like to jump right in. Whitney, tell us about our first letter.
All right, here's a letter from Dr. Nova. Hello. Ooh. Dr. Nova. Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. I think everyone expresses burnout if they do anything too much. We had a letter from B. Peterson last week about how too much.
Yeah.
B had consumed too many movies and was concerned that...
they were making a ton of podcasts.
Making a bunch of podcasts and felt a little bit sort of numbed by the experience after a while.
Only so natural.
Totally makes sense. I think everyone experiences burnout if they do anything too much. For me, it was Dungeons & Dragons and then movies.
Oh, yeah.
After about 6 months of not watching movies, I can watch movies again. But even now, I switch between B. Peterson and others. I think I have some tips for not getting burnt out as often.
That's a great idea. What is it?
Number one, don't feel obligated to watch a movie.
Yes.
This seems obvious, but still, hey, do you want to watch Star Wars? You can say no.
Yeah. And it's hard to listen to that voice sometimes because there's this general sense of, yeah, but I've seen all the other Star Warses. And it's like, yeah, but do you really care that much right now? Sometimes the answer is no.
And there's a whole FOMO thing. You don't see it. You're not going to be part of the conversation that's going on, you know, on social media. You're not going to be able to contribute. All of a sudden, you're an outsider because you skipped this movie. So, yeah, there's this kind of weird kind of social obligation
to watch
certain movies.
But I think if we all agree to just be a little bit more relaxed about that and just say, like, oh, you haven't seen it yet? Cool. You're going to get to it someday? No?
No.
Yeah, it's up to you.
Whatevs.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about something else.
Yeah.
It can be that simple. We don't have to be weird about this. Why is there peer pressure attached to everything?
I know some people, some professionals even, who buy, like, four or five tickets in advance for a movie before they've even seen it the first time.
How do you even know you're going to want to see it again?
Yeah, like they're committed to seeing it at least three or four times in a theater before they've even seen it once.
I mean, I guess if you're responsible for making like 8 YouTube videos about it, you better know it well.
I guess so,
but
you're
going
to need that access.
But that's not necessarily the case. Some people are just so confident that they're going to enjoy whatever the next Marvel or DC or Star Wars or whatever movie is. They just already committed to it. I'm like, no.
I don't know if I'm going to like it.
Yeah, I don't know yet. Maybe it stinks. It's very possible. Sometimes they do.
The one that gets me is I see articles all the time. Here are the most anticipated movies. Well, and like most anticipated, and then they're ranked. It's like, what units is anticipation measured?
Yeah.
What is an anticipation unit called?
It's a Lucasfilm.
It's
1L. 1LF.
1LF.
Yeah.
This one gets 50 on the LF scale.
Oh, God. But James Bond was at a 10LF, but now it's been pushed back so far, it's down to a measly 5.
I hate that crap. Anyway, number two, get off social media.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Just
advice.
In general, but this is a good idea. But mainly it allows you to not get distracted with thinking about how to talk about the movie or being worried about what people will think. For example, no one knows my opinion of the movie 1984 because it hasn't come up. Have you seen the
original 1984,
listener,
right?
That you mean the 1984 version of 1984.
Or it could be Wonder Woman 1984.
Oh, it just says 1984.
Well, I'm saying it could be. It works either way, I suppose. But but regardless, yeah.
There's been two film versions of the George Orwell novel. One came out in 1984.
That's and then there's the Wonder Woman movie.
No, and then...
That's a joke.
Wouldn't that have been great if she fought Big Brother?
That would have been cool, right? That would have been a great movie. I want to see that.
She's... what was the... the name of the Emmanuel Goldstein was the leader of the resistance in 1984.
Okay.
And I remember that because that was the real name of one of the hackers in the movie Hackers.
Oh, that's right.
They named him after Emmanuel Goldstein from
Resident Evil. Was it Matthew Lillard's
character? Matthew Lillard's character. Yeah, so it gave his name as Emmanuel Goldstein.
That's hilarious. But that's a good advice, too. It's also worth remembering that social media, especially Twitter, it's very curated.
Mm.
You know, you're choosing who to follow.
And the AI is also picking things out for you.
Yeah. So, like, every once in a while, I'll have to, like, pick up my partner's, like, phone for whatever reason or, like, whatever. And I get a glimpse at their Twitter feed. Mm. It's completely different from mine.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Everything,
yeah.
Like, they're the people that they're following are so much more concerned about stuff that the people I'm following are not.
Yeah.
And it's something where it's, like, I think of my Twitter feed as kind of reality. It's not. It's a very filtered version of it. It's just the people that I know.
That's the mistake people have made. And
it's easy to do.
It's all been in the news, and we're still doing it. It's like Facebook allowed all these algorithms to take over, and they allowed misinformation to leak out. We know that now, and yet we're still treating our social media feeds as if this is what the whole world is talking about.
I took a solid month off of Twitter, I think last summer. And it was so vital to me. And now I try to do it at least for a few days a month.
Yeah.
Like, I'll take, like, a whole weekend off or a whole week or something like that. And I'll try to usually not a whole week, but, like, you know, at least a few days just
try to break the addiction.
I have to post the podcast. When the podcast comes out, I have to go on the account and say, hey, the new podcast is up. Mm. But other than that, I'm gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number three, get different hobbies.
Yeah.
I have 3 movies, books, and Doctor Who. I'm working through all of Doctor Who right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I love it. But after a season, I don't watch the next season for about a month.
Great. Let
there
it
you
go. Sit.
Yeah. You don't have to marathon.
Let it percolate.
These things, a lot of, if you're into TV, they weren't made to be watched all in one sitting.
Well, not initially. Some are.
Well, some are now.
Yeah.
But if you're watching a show that was made before, 2003,
yeah,
that was kind of the turning point.
Basically, whenever 24 came out, it was around the early 2000s.
But, pre-24, those were made to be consumed on a weekly basis. Even 24 was meant to be consumed on a weekly basis.
That's true. It just happened to work the other way around. That's spectacularly good advice. There's so many other things you can do so many other things you can do with your time. There really are. They have value. Mm. They're meditative. They're exciting. They have exercise involved. I don't like those. But
you don't like meditating or exercise?
No, meditating is fine.
See, you don't like being still, and you also don't like moving.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's exactly it. That was the point I was trying to make. Right. But was there any more in the letter?
Yes. Okay. Number 4, don't make it your job. Oh, too late.
I'm out.
See steps 1 and 2. If this is your job, you'll probably be stuck on steps 1 and 2, which is don't feel obligated and get off social media.
Well, that's true to a point. You can totally look. Sometimes I have no choice, but sometimes I do, and I can decide. I can say no to things.
Yeah,
I usually don't because I like to see everything, but I also will be like, you know what? No, not this time. I don't. I have other. I have actual obligations to family, and I can't go to that screening. I'm sorry.
There's been something. One of the positive things to come out of the pandemic was, with theaters all shuttered, everybody sort of had to refocus their attention when it came to film.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people felt a lot freer to explore, a lot more interesting types of movies, kind of go into the corners where all of these, they were always there, but...
You don't have to exert all your energy on the same, because 3 blockbuster would come out every week.
Yeah.
3 giant mainstream, in multiple thousands of theaters every week.
Films were out of the conversation now, so people had to sort of find smaller films or older films to talk about.
We spent the whole month talking about Vast of Night on Twitter. Wow.
Wasn't that nice?
That's so good. I'm gonna miss that. There's a lot of things. Obviously, the pandemic was fucking awful, but there were some things about it where I'm just like, could we learn a couple of valuable lessons from that?
There was a time when we were all really obsessed with The Vast of Night.
Yeah,
which is an excellent film.
So
by the
good.
Way.
Do not forget that movie, please don't. If you haven't seen it, do.
But yeah, this sort of, we made it our job. We're stuck here. But it's something we chose.
But we can also, here's the thing, we can also quit. Yeah. We can also choose to only, if we wanted to, we can choose to only focus on certain things. Mm. I know people who only write about horror almost exclusively. Mm. And so if they watch anything else, that's for fun.
Yeah.
That's a thing. You can
and
do that.
And I'm reminded of the story of critic James Rocky. James yeah. Rocky left the biz very deliberately. He retired from film criticism.
Yeah.
He started his own...
He was a mainstay. Everyone yeah. knew. Yeah.
He was really well known, and he became so incensed over what he called, he coined this phrase, the anticipation industrial complex.
Yeah.
Which is, and it's even worse now than when he left, true. This idea that every conversation about film is about what's about to come out, and... we're talking about movies through the filter of what the marketing is telling us to talk about.
Yeah. We basically become tools of the marketing machine. Yeah, so our enthusiasm has become weaponized by corporations to make them more money, and it doesn't even feel genuine anymore.
No, and yeah. so we're being brazenly manipulated by advertising to the, and there's whole industries based on it.
Yeah.
What speculate? What's in this superhero movie? What mm-hmm. when is X character going to meet Y character?
Yeah.
Why are we talking about this? We haven't even seen the movie yet.
Especially as much as we do. It makes no sense.
Yeah, like it's a huge percentage yeah. of it.
And all it does is save Disney, Warner Brothers, whoever. It saves them a lot of money.
Yeah, you're now doing advertising for them. And James Rocky yeah. saw it happening. He's like, I don't want to write ad copy. I'm not here to advertise the movies. I'm here to discuss an art form I'm fond of. And he left. He started his own baking company.
Yeah, good for him.
I saw him
yeah.
at working at a Williams Sonoma shortly after he left the biz.
Luca's
playing with things on the table. Get off the table.
Get off the counter, Luca. Luca just jumped back into his cat tree and sullenly turned his back on us. He's just like, I'm mad at you both.
And there's one more. Okay. Number five, spend time with people.
Yes.
Being around people is very helpful. I suggest tabletop games. Dungeons and Dragons is always fun. I haven't played a role-playing game since college.
But I haven't either.
Freeing up time for yourself is going to be difficult. I don't know what your circumstances are.
Well, I also think that there's, your mileage is going to vary depending on how extroverted or introverted you are.
Mm-hmm.
You may not want to spend time with a lot of people. You may only want to spend time with one person. Mm-hmm. You may find that you need to spend more time with yourself and you're spending too much time with other people. But it is important to connect with humanity.
Yeah.
Whatever form that takes for you. I thoroughly agree with that.
And not the social media version where everybody's sort of a brand. Yeah. Talk to a person, at least if you're still
more or less quarantined, at least the Zoom call as opposed to the text. Yeah, at least talk to someone face to face,
I'm weird because I still call people on the phone and talk to them using my voice. Evidently this is a very strange practice now. Like people don't do that anymore. They don't have phone conversations.
Yeah.
Phone conversation. Why not? I have it.
I'm down.
Yeah, I hope this helps to remember to have some fun. And if you're not getting paid, and if neither is happening, then screw it all. Signed, Dr. Nova. P.S. I like 1984, but it feels like going through depression, so I'd rather not watch it again.
Okay, I think it's
1984.
This is all good advice. And again, as we talked about in the last episode of We've Got Mail, it's okay to be burned out. You don't have to force yourself to keep doing the same thing you've always done, or liking the same thing you've always liked, or
you can stop,
or buying every single issue of something, or seeing every single movie in a franchise. It's okay to just say, you know what, I'm good for now.
There's a moment of reckoning in every music fan's life,
mm-hmm.
where if they're following a certain musician or band and they're incredibly prolific, when do you stop buying their records?
Yeah,
like. At some point, you're going to have to stop, right?
Mm-hmm. Theoretically.
I'm a big fan of They Might Be Giants.
Sure.
I discovered them when I was 12, and they followed me throughout my youth. I'm fond of the band, and they're incredible, nothing if not prolific. They write 18 songs a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty crazy how much content they put out. I said content. I apologize.
Anyway.
How much music they make.
Yeah. It's not a great term. It's kind of disrespectful to the artist.
I stopped buying They Might Be Giants records at some point. It was just too much. Yeah. I didn't have the time or the patience to keep on listening to all of their records over and over again.
Yeah, I remember I had my moment of reckoning. It wasn't with music, but it was the time when I really just finally realized that I don't have to do shit. Because there's so many TV shows I'd watched to the end just because I saw the first four seasons. I might as well see the last two. And then I finally mentally did the math and I'm like, that's 40 hours of my life I'm going to piss away on something I'm not even into anymore. And I was watching True Blood, which is a show that, boy, did that show have its ups and downs, didn't it? Some really good stuff, some really fucking bad stuff. And
all I know about True Blood is that everybody got naked on
Everybody got super naked all the time. It was a very, very horny show. The last season, it got worse and worse and worse. The last like couple seasons weren't great. And the last season, and these were like HBO seasons, they weren't even that long. I got like 3 episodes into it, and I was like, you know what? I don't give a shit how it ends. I no longer care. I spent like half a decade with these fuckers. I no longer care how their story ends. That's how bad this has gotten. I don't care. I don't know. I don't want to know. I've never even looked it up on the Wikipedia page. I just didn't care anymore.
Yeah, that's
just never looked back.
Yeah, I haven't ever seen the third of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Okay.
Because I saw that first one. I thought it was overstuffed as is.
Sure.
It's like this.
Fun, but it's overstuffed,
It's fun, but there's too much of it. Like, there's shave this down. Then they made a second one, and it was even bigger and longer, and they said, okay, and there's going to be a third, like, the end of that movie, the main pirate is swallowed by a kraken, and they have to go to the afterlife to get him. And, and I didn't have the patience, so I just didn't go to see how that story concluded. Then they made 2 more. I saw those. Same with The Matrix. I wasn't going to see that third Matrix.
You never saw the third Matrix?
No, I have, but I didn't want to.
Okay.
I saw it under duress. I like The Matrix. I saw The Matrix Revolutions. Like, okay, we've gone... Just with that second film, they've already gone way down the rabbit hole. The filmmakers are disappearing up their own asses. This is too much for me.
I'm going to say this right now. I was when those movies came out, I thought they made some weird decisions. I'm not on board with a lot of them. But I haven't revisited those movies in at least 15 years. And I think I owe them a rewatch. So I'm probably going to rewatch them before the new one comes out. I've seen The Matrix 1 enough. I'm at least going to rewatch 2 and 3.
There's a digital pie orgasm in that movie.
I remember it was cake.
Whatever it is.
I remember the Merovingian is just like, I'm going to have a big, long monologue, and then this lady's going to have a tasty dessert, and then she's going to have an orgasm, and it's going to mean something. And I'm sitting here in a crowded theater in Westwood, California going... What
the fuck is happening in this movie?
And a part of me is impressed that we're even doing this big budget movie. But another part of me is like, what? Why are we? So I'm going to watch it again. I'm going to watch it again with like my modern perspective now, knowing what I having grown up a bit, and maybe I'll appreciate how daring it is. Maybe it'll connect with me on a very different level. Maybe I was immature and was expecting more shootout shit, and when it didn't give me that, I was mad. Maybe I was immature. I don't know.
No, but I was, you know, deep in the cult of The Matrix when it first came out in 99. I really loved the movie. I was really looking forward to the sequel. They said they were going to make this, like, one gigantic mega sequel. It's going to be 2 parts. And I saw the first part.
Pretty daring at the time.
And I saw the first part. I'm like, nope, I'm out. I didn't want to see the third one. Until a friend insisted. They said, you're not allowed. You're not allowed to skip it. You have to see how it ends. It's like, I don't care how it ends. I don't want to see this movie. But he paid for my ticket, and he dragged me along. And a really curious thing happened during The Matrix Revolutions. Nobody made a sound. I remember seeing the first Matrix film, and people were cheering and having a good time. And there was like energy in the room.
A lot of investment that we have in that
movie. There was a weird like religious like prayer toward the screen during that third one. Like people, were really sort of
we can't have fun with every detail. This is philosophy.
This is really serious. This is serious that the guys in the machine gun robot suits are firing bullets at space octopi. You know, it's like...
Hey.
And then there's...
Those were Earth octopi.
Excuse me.
They were subterranean Earth octopi. Get it right.
Sorry, the rare prairie squid.
They're not aliens. This isn't stupid.
Oh, sorry.
these are robot octopuses.
Meanwhile, from Earth. Meanwhile, inside Tron, Keanu Reeves is having a Dragon Ball Z fight with a million Hugo Weaving. He's like, what the...
It's weird, right? Anyway, we should move on. But thank you for that letter. That's really, again, always good to keep it in perspective. As much as you love something, perspective is really, really important. Let's move on.
Here's a letter from JB. Hello, JB.
Hi, JB.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. Longtime listener, maybe first-time emailer, I don't know. Yeah. I wanted to write in to provide a small but important clarification on the statements Bibbs had made in a recent letters episode in which the Taliban were mentioned in relation to the discussion about the ignorance of the American public and the inclusion of real places and events in a semi-fictitious manner. I'm not sure if that's the most accurate term for the phenomenon discussed, but let's roll with it. I'm by no means an expert as to the Taliban or Middle East political movements in general, but I generally graduated with a BA in political science along with a certificate in Islamic studies, so I feel like I can provide some helpful context to other listeners, assuming this letter is read on the air. Hey, here we are.
Yeah.
The Afghan insurgent groups that Bibbs mentioned as a part of the plots in films like The Living Daylights and Rambo 3 would have been the Mujahideen, which at the time of the films refers to numerous groups with different ethnic and ideological beliefs, but were united against the Soviet Union.
Okay, so I was wrong. Fair enough. Thank you for the correction.
This unification was generally built on a shared anti-communist ideology rooted in pro-Islamic identities. Important note, these films were released towards the ends of the Soviet-Afghan War from 79 to 89, and each of the films was released after Gorbachev announced and enacted the withdrawal of Soviet forces from the region, so the victory of the Mujahideen was essentially already on the horizon when the decision to include them in these stories would have occurred.
So the Western filmmakers who were, like, picking a side in that were already late to the fight.
Well,
not late. They were Monday morning quarterbacking. They were picking, like, a victor and, like, saying, oh, yeah, we're on their side the whole time.
Yeah.
Assholes.
The Taliban, as we know it today, formed during the Civil War after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and its leaders were former Mujahideen fighters that were spiritual and political leaders to their communities that organized a new generation of politically active Afghans around a particular religious militancy.
That explains how I got it wrong.
Yeah. To make a long story short, too late, Afghan forces in The Living Daylights and Rambo 3 were not the Taliban, but a united insurgency force known as the Mujahideen, whose victory in the Soviet-Afghan War would eventually provide the leaders of the Taliban with political and military legitimacy. I love all the shows you do, and I love the Salt Cat Soap products I have purchased.
Oh, thank you very much.
I hope that y'all have a good day. Best, JB.
Yeah, JB, thank you so much, and thank you so much. We try to do these things right, but there's so much information out in the world, we're going to screw something up. And when people can correct us, we always want you to. Please do.
Yeah. And it's valuable information, and I've said this before, as critics, we tend to rely on certain kinds of shorthand from time to time, and the catchphrase around movies like The Living Daylights is, oh, James Bond helped the Taliban.
Yeah.
Rambo helped the Taliban.
And that was a gross oversimplification.
It's an oversimplification. It's kind of like originally played as a flip joke that kind of like leaked into an actual part of the discourse, and that's lazy on our part.
And thank you. We need to make sure we don't take these things for granted. We need to be more careful with making sure the historical record is reasonably accurate. So thank you very, very much. That was awesome. So glad you wrote in.
Here's a letter from Jeremy. Hi, Jeremy. Okay. Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I'm sorry to bother you like this, since you're both much more intelligent and well-versed in film and literature than I am or ever will be.
Pshaw, I say.
I try, but only so much time. Clearly, I do appreciate movies and value your opinions, because I enjoy your podcasts and I am a member of your Patreon. Thank you for that. But you brought up a topic that my studies in music almost compelled me to write this email.
Great.
In a recent We've Got Mail, the one released on the 8th of September, you had a question about anachronistic music in film. You mentioned that a certain composer hated the music selection for Roman epics because the film music in Roman epics sounds more romantic. You mentioned that it sounds Baroque, but the style used in those movies is more romantic than Baroque or classical. And then you mentioned the show Rome had used actual music from that era in history.
I said that
because I haven't seen Rome, but that's what I had read about the show Rome. Okay. I admit I have never seen Rome or know what you were talking about, but I'm sorry to say that there is no existing music from the Roman era.
We have
the instruments that would have been used during that time period, but written musical notation in Europe only began sometime around the early 7th century. Before that, all music would have been transmitted via an oral tradition or style or music lessons. Mm-hmm. It's likely that the composer for Rome, Jeff Beal, or whatever show you were referencing, would have used historical instruments and forced himself to use the scales and tonalities specified by the limitations of those instruments to create his compositions. It would have been the closest to Roman music we could get, but until we develop a time machine and encounter the Guardian of Forever, we'll never know what Roman or Egyptian or Persian music would have truly sounded like. I admit I cannot speak to music of the Orient. I know that all of the oral tradition of music is far more consistent than in Western traditions, but I know very little about it. And we all have more to learn, don't we?
Ain't that the truth?
I was also wondering, that's so fascinating, though. I love that kind of history. I was also wondering, as soon as the question was posed on the podcast, about how I would answer the opposite. Are there movies where the story or film is trash, but the score or soundtrack is fantastic and stands on its own?
Wow.
The one I can personally think of is Moulin Rouge. I don't know what's going on with that movie, but that soundtrack I can listen to all day. Seriously, performing Roxanne by the Police as a tango with a super strong strings is, while driving, is amazing.
That's probably the musical highlight of that movie. I think
Roxanne!
That's a great bit. That bit's amazing. I think even if you don't like Moulin Rouge, I think we all got to admit that's a pretty epic cover of Roxanne.
I really hate Moulin Rouge.
I know you do.
It's such a shrill piece of work.
Is that the end of the letter?
Yeah. Anyways, I hope my rambling makes some sense, and I hope you both are very well. Sincerely, Jeremy.
Yeah, it's another great example. Like, boy, I wish my dad was alive, because he would have ripped me to pieces for getting anything wrong about ancient Rome. He was such an expert in ancient Rome. He would know everything that we said that was wrong. Thank you for writing in about that. It reminded me of, are you familiar with Kate Beaton, I think they still do it, but the comic strip Hark a Vagrant?
Oh, because of you, I'm familiar
with Hark a Vagrant is a comic strip I've been very fond of, and Kate Beaton has done like a lot of comics that were sort of looking at either history or historical figures or sometimes great literature, and just having a playful, on the lighter side take. And there's one a bit of hers that I always really liked, which was a wandering Middle Ages minstrel, you know, back up against a tree with
a lute,
with a lute, and like a woman like sitting there on the grass with her head in her hands listening to him, and he's just playing the lute, and these, you know, a couple of panels to set the scene, and then he just strums, "Shut through the heart, and thou'st to blame." Always made me laugh. So for all we know, ancient Rome was like nothing but hair metal. For all we know, we never know. That's a good point.
I know. I was a theater major, and there was a certain sound that was played on stages whenever we were doing like studying ancient theater, like ancient Greek theater or ancient Roman theater. It was all based on instrumentation, like as the listener wrote in, a lot of the instrumentation limited by what the instruments were at the time.
Sure.
So that it did have a certain kind of sound to it. And so that's what I associate with sort of ancient Roman, ancient Greek drama. That's still, however, not the sound that you would hear in Roman epic movies.
No,
so it was like two steps removed from any kind of actual accuracy.
But the inverse question, by the way, which is also good, which is the bad movies with good soundtracks. And I can think of a few off the top of my head. Xanadu. I love the soundtrack to Xanadu. I think that is a wonderfully poppy, disco inflected soundtrack. Some songs are better than others, but the good ones are really, really great and catchy. Wonderful electric light orchestra jams. The movie, I really want to like Xanadu. It's so dull.
It's
so dull. Michael Beck is so miscast. Like, the movie doesn't work. Not even on a camp level. It just doesn't work. But the soundtrack's really, really fun, and I do like
Olivia
it.
Newton-John is like, "Oh, yes, I'm a muse. What do you do?" Nothing.
I basically point you at an empty building and say, "Hey, what if you built a discotheque?" And they're like, "Oh, yeah, that'd be cool." Cool.
And Olivia Newton-John can dance.
Yeah, she can sing too.
Well enough.
She's okay.
But they made the mistake of having her dance with Gene fucking Kelly.
Yeah.
And it looks like she can't.
I know.
Like, she actually can.
And Gene Kelly. This,
she can hold her own.
That was Gene Kelly's last movie.
But
like,
she can't hold her own
like,
with Gene Kelly.
Yeah. My point is, this is Gene Kelly when he wasn't even as spry as he used to be. Mm-hmm. Still can't hold a candle. Mm. Another good example
Gene Kelly's last movie was technically Cats Don't Dance.
Okay, last
the,
live action.
The animated film. He was the dance consultant.
Okay.
Because they were animating dance.
But he's
characters.
Not on camera, though.
No,
or he doesn't play a character.
No.
Okay, well, but it was the last movie we worked on. That's interesting, though. A couple other things. Batman and Robin. Bad movie. Pretty good soundtrack. There's some neat stuff on that soundtrack.
Well, you and I grew up during the period when soundtrack records were a big business.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this numerous times.
Yeah.
About how a film could be a failure at the box office, but could recoup its losses with record sales. That's how big record sales were at the time.
Yeah.
And as such, a lot of money was put into finding hip new artists and licensing a lot of hot music to put in the movie and to put on the soundtrack record. As such, you have a lot of impeccably curated albums that are great to listen to for a movie like Dead Man on Campus.
Yeah.
You know, just like these really crap comedy films and just really bad dramas got these really, really like the Basketball Diaries. A lot of these films had some really, really wonderful soundtrack records.
Yeah.
Godzilla had a wonderful soundtrack record. And the movies are of varying quality. So this is actually something really common.
It's well, in the 90s in particular. I do want to say, I do want to make a point. I wanted to clarify. The Batman and Robin soundtrack is a good soundtrack, except for one song.
Hmm.
It's R. Kelly's Gotham City. Now, first off, R. Kelly, what a piece of shit. But even before that was like common knowledge to everybody, Gotham City is a shitty song. Okay, here's the chorus to Gotham City. I want to look it up and make sure I got it right. A city of justice, a city of love, a city of peace for every one of us. We all need it, can't live without it. A Gotham City. Oh, yeah. I don't think anyone ever told R. Kelly what Gotham City was actually like. Because every single version of Gotham City is not a city of justice, love, or peace, and it sure as fuck ain't for every one of us. Okay? We do not all need it. Many people would prefer to live without it. Gotham City, oh no. No.
It's like Partners in Crime did the rap song over the credits of the Ninja Turtles song.
Great.
Or Ninja Turtles movie.
Yeah, Turtle Power.
T-U-R-T-L-E Power.
Yeah, great. Great.
And the lyrics are about the events of the film.
Yeah.
And they name all the characters, and but they get details wrong. Like, they didn't watch Ninja Turtles before they wrote the song.
Yeah.
I mean, Raphael is the leader of the group.
Like,
transformed from the norm by the nuclear goop.
Wait, Raphael is what now?
He's, yeah.
What? Did Raphael write this song?
In the movie, there isn't a leader. There's just the four of them.
It's kind of Leonardo. Come on, but
you're taking that from the cartoon. No, where they explain I just think he
takes on a bit more of an authoritative older brother stance.
But he's not the leader of the group. The rat is the leader.
The rat is clearly the leader, but the rat's taken out of the equation. Okay, boy, right, I guess. Another movie that I know a lot of people have a lot of affection for this movie. I do not think this is a very good movie. I don't think it's a particularly terrible movie. But I also think it doesn't really capitalize on its promise. Dragonheart. Now, I know a lot of people love it. Some people are going, hey, I like Dragonheart. Fine. I would never call it a great movie. I think it's a B movie at most. The score is fucking phenomenal. The score for Dragon... I think was it James Newton Howard who did it?
Let me look it up. I just lost the Schmodown question because I don't know who did the score for Dragonheart.
Yeah. That Dragonheart score is like seriously one of the most... Oh, it was Randy Edelman.
Okay.
One of the most epic scores anyone has ever composed for any movie. And it's for this movie in which Dennis Quaid teams up with CGI Sean Connery to stop a giant annoying CGI king.
Giant CGI character in 1996 was a bit of a novelty.
Very novel at the time. Yeah. Doesn't hold up great today, but at the time, very novel. The special
effects were, like, they weren't... Like, it wasn't Jurassic Park level CGI, but it was considered impressive enough.
Yeah.
It was...
They got away with it.
Corny film. Nobody really liked it.
There's not really a lot of magic to it. There's not a lot of atmosphere to it. It just feels like they coasted on the idea and Sean Connery, frankly. But the score is... Nobody told Randy Edelman it wasn't the best movie ever made, because that dude made one of the great epic fantasy scores ever. if nothing else, at the very least, outshines the movie. I think that's fair to say.
I'm very fond of the opening theme song to a really crappy video game adaptation called Wing Commander. And Matthew Lillard.
The movie's not as bad as people make it out to be. It's not good, but it's also not. It's also not a huge stinker. It's just low budget sci-fi film about teens in space.
Well, low budget sci-fi trash. Not particularly interesting. But they
it's not. It's not painful.
They got this gigantic orchestral sweeping, like Star Wars style score for the opening with like a lot of trumpets.
I'm gonna listen to that.
Bum 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 bum. Yeah, it's like really, really bold and exciting. It's like, oh, this is gonna be you didn't have a lot of money. Freddie Prinze Jr. is not. I don't want to watch him in this movie.
I remember I actually had this vibe too when I rewatched the Dungeons and Dragons movie. They've done some straight to video Dungeons and Dragons movies. Some of them are actually okay, but the
2001.
Yeah, the 2000 with Jeremy Irons and Thora Birch, and
it's directed by a guy named Courtney Solomon.
Yeah, Richard O'Brien's in it as well. It's a weird cast, all over the place cast. It's one of those casts. Where it's like, who was available that week? We'll take them even if they're as long long as they're a big name, doesn't matter if they fit. But that's
it's pretty awful.
It's not a good movie. Yeah. But I remember, and I thought it when the first time I watched it, I thought the second time I watched it, whoever did the score for that movie did a real score. Like, they were trying to save the film by giving it this, like, kind of upbeat, epic adventure score that the movie... It was... The score wrote a check the movie couldn't cash. That's basically what it boiled down to. Sorry, but there's a lot of good examples. Let us know if you have any favorites. We'd be very curious to hear about them.
Yeah. What's a movie you hate, but you love the music?
Yeah, yeah. Whether it's the soundtrack or the score or both, whatever. Be very curious to hear. Right.
Here's a letter from Jinxie. Hello, Jinxie.
Hi, Jinxie.
We've heard from Jinxie before.
Indeed.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I disagree. What? They can disagree.
I know.
This is a Star Trek letter.
Oh, okay.
I disagree with your reading of how Geordi LaForge responds to Riker giving him sight. This is in reference to...
This is just today.
Just today, yeah. So we got a brand new letter.
Yeah, we recently did it. We have a podcast called All Our Yesterdays on our Patreon. Mm-hmm. We're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek in production order, and we've recently started doing about halfway through season one of Next Generation. We ran into the episode Hide and Q, in which Q, a godlike being, if you don't follow Star Trek, decided to give Commander Riker, the second in command of the USS Enterprise, godlike powers. And Riker decided to prove that he could handle those godlike powers by bestowing benevolent gifts of anything people wanted amongst the crew, but it turns out they were all things people didn't actually want, and he didn't actually understand the human spirit as well as he thought he did.
Yeah,
that's the overall message of the episode.
Anyway, I disagree with your reading of how Geordi responds to Riker giving him sight. Bibbs said that people aren't defined by their disabilities. I am disabled. I am a woman, and my disability is every bit a defining part of my life as much as the fact that I'm a woman, that I'm bisexual. If you were to take away any of those things through a hand wave, it would change the very essence of who I am.
Yeah.
Riker, on the other hand, is an abled guy who sees Geordi's disability as something that he can and should be fixed. That's why Geordi is horrified, because Riker has taken away a huge part of who Geordi is. Well, that's not all he is. It's a big part of who he is, and Star Trek The Next Generation has never shied away from Geordi being disabled, and that makes him who he is. It's one of the times that Star Trek has handled disability brilliantly, and Geordi was one of the people who had actually helped me become comfortable with accepting who I am. Just my perspective, Jinxie.
Jinxie, thank you so much for writing in, because I apparently fucked up, because that's more what I was trying to convey, and apparently I failed. I really wanted to articulate that I didn't want to say people weren't defined by their disability, because I know a lot of people who are disabled. I myself have a bad knee. It's not the same thing, but it's something I wrestle with every day. I was trying to say that the idea that Riker was saying that Geordi LaForge's story could be resolved, his journey could be resolved by quote unquote fixing his disability, is something that Riker believed.
Yeah,
he didn't understand that Geordi was that his disability was part of who he is, and Geordi didn't necessarily want to be fixed.
If I may,
please.
What I think you were trying to get out here was Riker was looking at Geordi and only seeing his disability.
Yeah, he was
defining
his vision
Geordi
is a problem to be solved
by his disability, and I think that's what you meant when you said people aren't defined by their disabilities. Where Geordi is a full person; he's not just a blind guy. And in fact, Star Trek has always been really good with the Geordi LaForge character in particular.
Yeah,
with never really making his disability something to like an instrument of pity.
Yeah,
it's like. And the fact that Riker thought to do this actually isn't part of the thesis of the show. In fact, it points out how wrong Riker was to have that viewpoint.
Yeah, that was a very ableist viewpoint on Riker's point. I sincerely apologize if that's how I came across. I think I was trying to balance what Riker's viewpoint was versus what Geordi's viewpoint was, and I think I got muddled there. We record these late at night. And sometimes I'm a little bit more of a jumble, and I need to, that is a great wake up call for me to be more careful, especially when dealing with sensitive topics and to be articulate, because I want to be corrected when I'm wrong. And please correct me when I'm wrong. And I came across wrong. Definitely. That wasn't what I wanted to articulate. And if I did that, I fucked up and I feel very bad about that. So thank you so much for telling me. Thank you for bringing it to our attention. That's what I meant. That's 100% that is the perspective that the show, I think, comes across.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up and making that part of the conversation.
I'm trying to think of other, because I've seen all of Star Trek The Next Generation. I'm trying to think of other instances where Geordi's blindness is brought up at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until like the movies that they started to like address his eyesight differently. I mean, those four Next Generation movies are like all of them are pretty bad. And
I still think you're a little hard on First Contact, but okay.
First
Contact is the Wrath of Khan. It like kind of doesn't fit, but it's also pretty good for what it is.
It's trying to be action schlock with actors who are already in their 60s. It's like, no, due to the diplomacy stories now, we don't need you, Picard in a tank top hanging from stuff.
I digress. My point is, I think that one gets away with it. But
In the first movie, in Generations, the villain kind of mocks his eyesight.
Yeah.
But that's the villain. You know, he wants to sort of show kind of how villainous he is.
Yeah.
In Insurrection, that's the one that takes place on a planet where everybody is like healed and becomes a little bit younger.
And like kind of immortal, yeah.
Yeah, and they live forever if they stay on that planet. And even though he was born without them... his like ocular nerves grow back. Geordi's ocular nerves grow back.
Yeah.
And there's a few scenes where he has eyeballs again. Yeah. Like he doesn't have the contacts on.
Yeah.
In First Contact, he doesn't have the visor anymore. He's had implants that look like eyes now.
Which, to be fair, was teased at the series finale of Next Generation that would be a technology that was available to him.
Yeah.
But we didn't realize it would be that soon. So I guess they just figured LeVar Burton was tired of the visor.
Maybe so.
Yeah, probably just tired of the
voice. Like it'd been a couple of years since he'd been played Geordi. It's like, can I? He did wear that over his eyes. His vision was obscured when he was playing Geordi LaForge.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for writing in. Thank you for correcting us. Thank you for seriously bringing that to our attention. And I sincerely apologize for coming across so badly. That's not what I meant to say.
You misspoke, and
no, I just want people to know I do take it very, very seriously. I don't want to be flippant about it. It means a lot.
You're not a villain.
I hope not, but you know, I don't want to become one either by disregarding anything. So thank you so much.
Here's a letter from Cody. Hello, Cody.
Hi, Cody.
Dear Rockmeister McCool and Nitro Bibs.
Ooh. Ooh.
I'll flip on the afterburners.
Nice stars.
As fellow appreciators of The Muppets, I must ask you this question.
Okay.
Was Fozzie Bear actually a good comedian, or did he deserve all of the heckling from Statler and Waldorf? Best wishes, Cody.
That may be the best question we've ever been asked.
We do tackle the important things.
Thank you. Winnie, your thoughts.
Fozzie sucks. That's the point of the character, is that he is a bad comedian. I have not ever laughed at a Fozzie joke, and that's kind of the point. He only tells groaners.
Mm-hmm.
And his lack of skill as a comedian, not his lack of passion, not his gentle nature, his good friend. I think he's an invaluable member of the crew when it comes to wrangling things, but he's the thing you put on because you have something good coming on later.
Yeah, he makes everything after him look better.
Yeah. He's the one you're putting in front of the curtain while they're changing the stage behind you. So he fulfills a function.
I'm actually going to slightly disagree with you here. Slightly.
Okay.
I would argue that Fozzie is not intentionally a great comedian. I think Fozzie is very genuine in that his sense of humor is not great, tends towards not only bad puns, but also to oversell his punchline and to demand applause for a groaner. Mm. That's not, generally speaking, a particularly great way to get the audience on your side. Mm. However, I would argue that, although he probably didn't start out this way, and maybe he was never doing it intentionally, I think as Kermit, as their director, producer, has implemented the work of Fozzie, I think he has turned Fozzie into the best version of himself, which is I'm going to take everything Fozzie does, and I'm going to make him into an Andy Kaufman routine. Andy Kaufman is one of the great comedians, but he didn't get up there and tell jokes. He would just do weird shit. He would get up there and read all of the Great Gatsby. all of it.
He would do,
do the whole fucking book.
He would do jokes that sound funnier when you're relating the experience after the fact than any laughs you got during the actual joke.
And oftentimes he would do bits that were intentionally not funny. Mm. Like he would do like a I'm not going to do his like funny voice, but he would do a bit like, okay, I'm going to do my impression of Archie Bunker. Mm. Hey, you, get out of my chair. Thank you. That was Archie Bunker. Like the joke is that's not a funny joke. Mm. And I think that's the joke with Fozzie. The joke is we keep putting him out there even though he's not funny.
Yeah.
We keep putting him out there. That's the commitment. You have to sit through those jokes. And the fact that we engage with Statler and Waldorf, who pay to be here. Every night they buy those tickets. And we get laughs out of them. We're taking advantage of Statler and Waldorf using Fozzie as bait. That's a genius move.
Fozzie is essentially the straight man to Statler and Waldorf.
He is, even though he's the one who's telling the jokes. That's a brilliant bit. I think he is accidentally a brilliant comedian, and I think if you explain that joke to him, he'd stop being funny.
Can't do it on purpose.
No. I think he's got to be directed. He's got to be a little manipulated into like give. It's like the story that like Slim Pickens didn't know that Dr. Strangelove was a comedy.
Mm.
If he did, he probably would have played that role very differently, and it wouldn't have been as funny. Mm. I think that's the thing with Fozzie. I think Kermit knows what he's doing with Fozzie. I think he knows what Fozzie is good at. And he knows that Fozzie, even though he's not a great comedian, has an impact on the audience that can be very useful.
Yes.
And as a result, I think Fozzie is an integral part of The Muppet Show. I think he is a brilliant part of The Muppet Show. But the fact that he's a bad comic is what makes him great.
Mm. But... well done.
Dust
well
off put my forth. Hands. Thank you. Pulled that right out of my butt. Just thought of that now.
You need bad comedians to see which ones are good. Yeah, so they're useful in a certain sort of way. What do you get when you put chocolate pudding in your mother's shoes? You get a spanking.
okay, that's kind of
fun. That's a Fozzie, isn't
it? That's actually pretty good. That's pretty good. I like that. I think we're with that. That's kind of
what one he was trying to tell to the fat sailor. There was this sailor that was so fat. Sailor. How fat was he? He was so fat that everybody liked him, and there was nothing funny about him at all. Fozzie, the Muppet Show was based on a lot of old... it was
vaudeville.
Sort of like old vaudeville tropes. It was this live show.
And everyone had a different act, different musical numbers every night. Yeah,
And the whole bit with the Muppets was... it was sort of... the joke was that it's all now these like weird puppet characters doing these old sort of numbers. And some of them were legitimately good.
Mm-hmm. And, most of them were
impressive,
not.
Impressive puppetry, but the whole joke was these non-human creatures are trying on a human habit. And the juxtaposition between those two realities is where the humor comes from.
Yeah. Like they've got a whole show. They're not actually good at it, but there's something charming about their complete sincerity and their delivery.
Yeah, Fozzie Bear's comedy is—he's like a space alien.
Yeah,
he saw some vaudeville routines, like, oh, let me try that, and he doesn't understand how humor functions. To go back to Star Trek, there's a few episodes where Data tries to tell jokes.
Oh, we already had one of those. Yeah, and he's like really weirdly aggressive with it, and it ruins. Yeah. It's not a good joke to begin with, but because he's so aggressive in the telling, he doesn't understand the nuance of the language.
Yeah, there's going to be an episode where he doesn't understand jokes, so he goes to the holodeck and takes lessons from of all people, Joe Piscopo.
Ah, yes,
Joe Piscopo was on Star Trek.
Greatest comedian in history, like Joe Piscopo.
He's not playing Joe Piscopo, but he's also playing a stand-up comedian.
He's also Joe Piscopo. And he knows people know who he is.
Yeah.
They're playing off of it. But that is pretty damn funny. Yeah.
So Fozzie is like, he's almost like Neil Hamburger and that it's like Dada comedy.
Yeah.
Like it's set up.
That's what I'm saying. It's kind of
in this,
weird non-comedy comedy.
It's a children's joke book comedy where it's not meant to make you laugh. It's meant to teach you the way comedy is constructed.
Yeah.
How to deliver a joke. And he's still, and he got stuck on lesson one.
Yeah. There's a setup, there's a payoff, but I'm not going to learn how to, like, deliver it in a funny way. Mm. I'm not going to learn timing. I'm not going to learn how to, like, get you ingratiated into the setup so that you don't see the punchline coming. Mm. Nope. I'm just going to do an awkward setup. I'm going to yell the punchline as loud as I can, and then I'm going to scream, waka, 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 as if that will make everything funny. Oh. When you said that Fozzie was an alien, my first thought is waka, waka, waka translate to, like, please love me? Please love me. I tried so hard with that joke. I worked really hard.
He's summoning his leaders.
Please love me.
I would love to see a double bill with Fozzie and Neil Hamburger. Just that'd be
great. I would have loved Fozzie and Andy Kaufman. I think that would have been perfect. They would have had so much in common. I don't think they would have told a single joke. I think they just would have enjoyed each other's company and talked and talked. And then Andy Kaufman would have wrestled Miss Piggy and lost. And it would have been great. That would have been amazing. All right, then we got time for one more.
All right. Here's a letter from Landon. Hello, Landon. Hey, Landon. Greeting Biggs and Rockmeister Bagul.
That's great.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
Bagul's from the movie Sinister.
Yeah, God, that first movie's great.
Love the show. Like Whitney, I really enjoyed the movie Night Books. Oh, that's, yeah, Night Books was a delightful film.
Still haven't seen it. I'm going to watch that soon. Yeah. It sounds really fun.
It's great gateway horror. I especially liked the Evil Dead-like camera zooms and the Drag Me to Hellish witch at the end. My one big complaint were that the stories were within the story, if they were actually scary, like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, creepy, the book, not the movie, it would have elevated the movie to a sleepover kids classic. The ones they used were just kind of meh. But I love the show, Landon. Thanks for a second opinion on Night Books. Night Books is... I feel like horror for kids has really been excelling in recent years because I really liked that Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark movie.
That was good.
I know a lot of people were sort of down on it. I don't know why.
It was a little longer than it needed to be, but it was creepy and pretty good.
The sequence with the woman walking down the hallways, there's a scene where one of the characters has had this vision of this like horrifying, like kind of monstrous woman who wanders down a hallway and he can't get away. And he's at this cross section of two really long hallways, and he can look down four directions. And every direction he turns, the woman is there, and each time she's a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And it's all saturated in red, and she's actually has this weird sort of placid expression. That's fucking terrifying scene.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the sequence with that. One of my favorite scary stories as a kid, and by favorite I mean it fucked me up, was the story of the Scarecrow Herald. From Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which is just Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. They're not all terrifying. Some of them are silly. Some of them are just sort of general campfire tales. But Harold is really gory and gross. Like, it's a real kind of a mature scary story, and it's really macabre. And I thought they handled that one really, really well. Yeah,
but there was that one. There's
The first Goosebumps is really good.
Yeah, the first Goosebumps film. Second one, fun monster stuff.
It's just repeating the first, basically. It's more of the same. But the first one's solid.
To a degree, It. I know It is, it's an R-rated film. That's for
I think if you just watch the first one in a vacuum, there's you could probably get
some good haunted house imagery in those movies.
A movie that you and I like that most people sort of glossed over was Joe Dante's The Hole.
Which is from 2000. It's a little bit older, but
it's more 2010. It's a rock solid film about these two kids who move into a house and they find a hole in their basement that's infinite.
Whatever you're most afraid of climbs out of the hole.
Yeah, which is a gimmick a lot of horror movies have done, obviously. But the hole does it really, really well. And it culminates when they actually have to dive into the hole. And that whole bit is pretty damn epic and good. A very underrated Joe Dante joint, and it's scary, but it's good for kids. Yeah. I think it's a good gateway horror film.
And Dick Miller's in it. He plays the pizza guy.
Yeah.
He has no lines. More recently, I was very fond of Vampires versus the Bronx.
That's a
really good movie. I really like Night Books. And I already mentioned the Fear Street movies that came out this year.
Those are a little more violent. They're definitely not for younger kids. That's more of junior high school sleepover kind of vibe. But they're still...
There's a younger audience in mind there. And keep in mind that...
The younger people are represented better in that one, which is why I think it matters. But it's still very hard art.
Recall, you and I grew up... as young kids watching R-rated horror movies.
Am not judging. I want to make that abundantly clear. I'm not saying kids shouldn't see violent movies.
What 10 and 11-year-olds are probably watching Fear Street.
What I am saying is that if anyone here's what it boils down to, because I agree with you. And I saw Predator when I was 5 in theaters. I saw RoboCop when I was 5 in theaters. And I turned out more or less fine.
We turned out okay.
I was seeing really violent, action movies and horror movies, whatever, and I could handle them. Sometimes I got scared, but usually I didn't, and I had parents who talked it over with me, and they loved cinema, and we really talked about cinema, and all that stuff was great. I am not ever gonna say that, we need to, protect kids from seeing R-rated movies in general. Anyway, some, yes. Some are definitely not designed for kids in mind. But the idea that, like, oh, it's R-rated and violent, a kid shouldn't see it. No. But what I do appreciate is that as critics, I know some parents look to us to just sort of have a general sense of what the content of a film is, so that they can decide whether it's appropriate to show to their kids, provided that they are still in a position to manage what their kids are consuming. So, like, if you're like, if your kids are putting together a slumber party and, like, you're helping them curate it, you should know that Fear Street is not a PG-13. Fear Street is quite gory, but it's also got really great teen characters. It's designed for teens.
I would say it's acceptable for a 13-year-old.
It's for a 13-year-old,
maybe. From my own perspective.
For a 13-year-old, maybe. But at the same time, like, for little kids, there's some stuff in there that will fuck them up. There's something there that's really, like, traumatically violent, and you should be aware of that. Some kids are going to be okay with that and deal with it great. Some are not. I think it's our responsibility to make you aware of that, but not to tell you how to live your life and how what movies to show your kids. That's not our job. I just take that seriously. I think Paranorman is another great... another great one. It's a stop-motion animated movie, but it's also a horror movie, too, and it's a really, really good one. I'm very fond of it.
And that's one for weird little kids. There was that one year where we got Paranorman, Frankenweenie, and Hotel Transylvania.
Oh, those are all
like,
good.
All within, like, 3 months of each other, and those are all good movies.
Only Paranorman's really, like, a gateway horror thing. The other ones are just kind of, like, spooky movies for kids, but those are all really good films.
There's a scene in Frankenweenie where kids learn that if they... electrocute their pets, they turn into monsters.
Yeah, I mean, that's fun. Don't get me wrong.
It's twisted shit. And, like, as the
pet, creepy, but I wouldn't call it scary.
The scene where, like, the cat turns into a monster would have fucked me up as a child. Like, right, there's some really scary stuff in that.
Maybe that's the case. And, of course, some of the classics from when we were younger. The Lost Boys is a little violent, but mostly okay for kids. And that movie's pretty great.
You think so?
I saw that when it came out. It was a kid. When I grew up, that was a kid's movie. it's violent. There's a lot of, like, stakes to the heart or whatever like that, but everything turns out more or less okay. You know, it was a kid's movie, but again, that's more of a, that's more of a junior high slumber party thing than, like, a movie you show your 7-year old. The Monster Squad was another one of those. It's a little violent at times, but it's mostly great for kids.
I didn't see either of those movies when I was a kid.
I grew up with both of them.
I saw The Monster Squad in college, and I saw The Lost Boys last year for the first
time. Year he saw The Lost Boys. Wow. It
took me a while to get to that one.
Whew.
My one criticism of The Lost Boys is, why weren't the Frog Brothers also vampires? They should have been.
The whole time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's about the... It's essentially, like, the three main characters. There's Diane Weiss, there's Jason Patrick, and there's Corey Haim.
Yeah.
And... Diane Weist, it turns out, we learn at the end of the movie. I can't spoil this movie anymore.
This movie is like 35 years old, and it's considered kind of a genre classic. Yeah, so I think it's okay.
It's revealed that the fellow that was romancing her was a vampire. Edward Herman was seducing her. Jason Patrick, and this is the main part of the movie, is being seduced by the local JDs.
Joining their cool, sexy motorcycle club.
And it turns out they're all vampires, and that's pretty obvious from the start. And... wouldn't it make more sense if the kid was also being seduced by vampires, but using, like, comic book language, the kind of stuff he's into?
Yeah, so...
That would be seductive for him.
So Corey Feldman is just like, hey, come hang out with the cool kids. We talk about comics. Ha-ha, we're vampires.
Yeah, that would have made perfect sense to me.
But there aren't really good vampires in this universe, at least not full vampires.
Well, why do they have to be good? Why can't they... They want
They're the ones who tell people how to fight the... Their function in the story is to tell people how to kill vampires.
Yeah, that's...
So we just don't have that, and Corey Haim, just no one finds out?
No, they're just wrong. Or they're lying to him.
Okay. That's a twist.
That would have made a lot more sense to me if it turns out the Frog Brothers were also vampires.
When I grew up, the Frog Brothers were, like, unassailable heroes. I don't know if I could handle them. Frog Brothers were just... There was a general understanding that the Frog Brothers were here to protect us all. And there was this general sense amongst me and, like, my friends in school where it's like... telling you, man, when they grow up, they're going to, like, kick the Ghostbusters' butts. Like, they're just going to be the ultimate supernatural hunting badasses.
I expected a scene where it's like, oh, yeah, and you can drive a stake through the vampire's heart, and, like, Corey Haim actually does it. And he's like, oh, shit, that actually works. Oh, no. We've been teaching him how to kill us. And, you know, and they run, and he ends up...
Well, there's a moment in the movie where it's the whole bit where if you invite a vampire in, you have no power over the vampire. And Corey Haim's like, you guys knew that, right? The father was like, oh, yeah. Everybody knows that. Like, no, they had no idea.
Yeah.
it's a bit of guesswork involved. But I digress. Fun movies regardless. Thank you everybody for writing in. This has been a really fun episode of We've Got Mail. If you want to write into a future episode, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. Box. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
64156, Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Thank you to everybody who's written in. I didn't get a chance to check the P.O. Box before today's episode, so we might, if there's anything in there, we might double up next week. Yeah, so we also, we're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibel.
Special shout out to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. None of our shows would exist without you. Thank you for your support. It means the world to us. If you can afford to join the show, you know, there's a lot of exclusive podcasts that we do over there, polls to help determine the future of our various shows, what movies we're going to review and the like. Mm-hmm. We do hangouts online. It's a whole business. But if you can't afford to join in, there's other ways to support the show. Follow us on Twitter. Leave us a review if you haven't already. Please subscribe if you haven't already. If anyone you know is looking for recommendations for podcasts, let them know we exist. You know, they have like awards for podcasts and things. I don't know how people get nominated for those. I don't think
what?
They do. I hear people like see podcast online, it's like, awards. Like, hey, yeah, you know, don't forget to vote for us for podcast awards. And I'm like, really? Seems kind of rude to ask.
Write in and let us know what podcast awards are in the world, because I don't know what we'd win.
I don't know at all.
Nominate us for a Pulitzer. Let's see if we can get one.
What episode?
Podcasting.
What episode is going to get us a fucking Pulitzer, Whitney? I'm really curious to know what you think.
The episode where we review Cats. Well, submit that one to the Pulitzer nominating
committee. Okay. Anyway, thank you everybody for listening. Please remember all of those things that we said. Mm-hmm. And until next time, sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.